From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I don't think that I could just go on Twitter and make funny jokes about the current administration without somebody basically saying, you know, you're going to dig on Jeff Sessions? What about the Lost finale? Maybe Jeff Sessions could find out where the polar bears came from.
Writer-producer Damon Lindelof wrapped up the hit series Lost in 2010, and he still gets lashed by fans who hated the ambiguous ending. Now, as Lindelof launches the final season of The Leftovers on HBO, another series that revolves around a mystery, he's neither reading nor writing tweets. He talks to Michael Schneider about deciding to end The Leftovers after three seasons and explains why his role as a showrunner puts him in a painful position if there's another writer's strike. But first on the news banter, advertisers flee Bill O'Reilly's show, What's a Murdoch to Do? Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, Matt, I'm not great with numbers, so several numbers I'm losing track of. How many women have settled sexual harassment complaints against Bill O'Reilly at Fox News? How many advertisers are dropping the show? We don't know for how long. How much can Fox News stand the pain? How much money have they spent to settle these lawsuits? We do know that they make a lot of money from O'Reilly's show.
Yeah, they make, according to Kantar Media, over a three-year period, they made almost $450 million in revenue from the O'Reilly show, which makes his $18 million a year salary seem like, you know, a pittance. So overall, the value proposition to Fox News is pretty high in having O'Reilly on the air. The testament to that is the fact that they re-upped his contract, even though they knew this New York Times story was in the works about the settlements and all of the allegations of sexual harassment against him. So Fox has made its choice on O'Reilly. They back him and they will deal with the fallout of that until potentially the noise around him becomes so great that they have to act. And that's the question. Will there be enough noise and enough advertiser boycott around O'Reilly where they feel like they need to make a move?
Yeah, you know, this is like a thing that you would invent to torture the Murdochs. You know, Rupert has been running, overseeing Fox News since Roger Ailes was ousted for, oh my God, the terrible allegations of sexual harassment and misconduct. Normally, a guy like Bill O'Reilly would be fired by any other company, I think, in any other business. Only in this context does a guy like this, with these allegations and these settlements, which are very incriminating, survive this long. And, you know, one of these women recorded him, so it's not like we're unsure that he was capable of this kind of behavior. These seem to be more than mere allegations. So normally it would be like, you're out, but there's too much money involved. And when they got rid of Roger Ailes for his misbehavior, they kept key managers who were clearly enabling Roger Ailes and his misconduct in place. So the culture at Fox News has remained toxic. And, you know, this is the kind of thing where the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, they would go to court against a company like this, file a complaint because of systemic discrimination. But in this case, we have a Trump administration, so it's unlikely that anything like that will happen. It's unlikely that the U.S. attorney, which was investigating Fox News, Preet Bharara, who was the U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York, was then fired. We just don't see that Trump, the biggest fan of Fox News out there, is going to take action. And this is purely a decision now that the Murdochs seem free to make.
Yeah, the fascinating overlay in this entire scandal is the Trump factor. You have the president of the United States saying publicly that he's defending Bill O'Reilly and he's a good person and he doesn't think he did anything wrong.
Oh, I mean, the irony there, yes.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Trump is not a, how you say, a benign observer of this kind of situation. But when you have the president backing you, that doesn't give you a lot of incentive to act to fix the problem.
Yeah, so we can just think about what it's like for Lachlan and James Murdoch, especially I think James. Lachlan is sort of believed to be the more conservative brother and more deferential to his father. I can't imagine they're fans of this kind of thing, but their dad is in charge still of this particular aspect of the company, even though he's handed over certain duties to them. I would just think that the family conversations would be super interesting right now.
Yeah, and I mean, let's be honest. I don't think Rupert is a fan of any of this behavior either and is probably equally upset about it. But he has enabled this for a long time with Roger Ailes in charge of what was essentially a rogue political operation masquerading as a news network. And to Roger Ailes, that's what it was. He treated it that way, and he enabled a lot of things, and he himself allegedly... There was a lot of behavior there that required him to leave when it was uncovered.
Well, and I don't think much has changed.
That's the real question going forward, is this push-pull between the formula that has made Fox the juggernaut that it is and the profit-minting machine that it is, and the culture there that increasingly is being exposed and increasingly is anachronistic and doesn't seem like it can last long-term.
And not legal, let's just be clear. So let me turn for a moment to Paramount. We had talked about the likelihood that Jim Giannopoulos, formerly of the Fox Film Studio, would end up there, and he actually started there on the 3rd of April. Jim Giannopoulos is a capable veteran of a studio. You know, he knows what he's doing in many respects, but boy, does he have his work cut out for him, starting with, you know, this, I believe that they have been meeting with these Chinese companies that are supposed to be financing up to $1 billion worth of their slate in the years ahead. That is a deal that was precarious. The Chinese were concerned about who was going to be running the film studio. And he also has this tremendous issue. He does not have a wealth of franchise material, which is what the studios are obsessed with and making, in some cases, in a few cases, money on or losing money on.
Yeah, that was on display this past weekend when Ghost in the Shell, a Paramount movie that it had positioned as a potential franchise for Scarlett Johansson, really underperformed at the box office. It was not very well reviewed, and there was this whole whitewashing controversy where a Japanese property was cast with an American actress in the lead role, and there was a lot of outcry about that. And I do believe it hurt the box office, the negative attention on that. Probably not a lot, but I think it did hurt it. And a Paramount exec has gone on the record saying they believe it did hurt the film as well. It just highlights the challenges that you have at a studio that is not overflowing with pre-branded, pre-sold properties that you can turn into films.
Not even close to overflowing. And of course, Ghost in the Shell costs significantly more than $100 million. And that is not a good thing. So as I said, Jim Giannopoulos has his work cut out. Meanwhile, at Sony, another studio lacking franchises, you know, they're cruising into the box office as we're speaking with the Smurfs film. The tracking doesn't look so good, and the brutal competition from Disney, Beauty and the Beast, DreamWorks Animation's Boss Baby. It's hard to find a weekend to open a film at all these days, but especially if the franchise looks a little weak, it just appears that Sony will take yet another shot with Smurfs.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Sony thought Beauty and the Beast would be quite as big and that Boss Baby would be quite as big as well. But those are two family films that are just going to trample over this franchise.
It's hard out there. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. The HBO series The Leftovers is a supernatural drama based on a novel by Tom Perata, who is also an executive producer on the show. Initially, the story revolved around a handful of citizens in the fictional town of Mapleton, New York, dealing with the aftermath of a rapture-like event in which 2% of the world's population suddenly disappeared. Season 1 pretty much covered the entire plot of the novel, so Season 2 went off book, so to speak. Perata and our guest today, Damon Lindelof, continued the story, adding new characters and shifting the action to a mysterious small town in Texas. Now in the third and final season of The Leftovers, the series jumps ahead in time to the days leading up to the 7th anniversary of the mass disappearance. Christopher Eccleston plays a minister who tries to reassure his flock, while Scott Glenn plays a retired police officer with a history of mental illness and a flair for prophecy.
What will happen on October 14th, just a couple of weeks from now? Probably nothing. But if something does happen on October 14th, you've all come to the right place.
On the 7th anniversary of the sudden departure, the rains will come, and with them, a great flood.
Lindelof was co-creator of the ABC mega hit Lost. At times, during its 6th season run, more than 20 million people tuned in to see if those ill-fated airline passengers would ever get off that island. The Leftovers has attracted only a tiny fraction of that audience, but it has a devoted fan base and critical acclaim. Before the start of the third season, which begins April 16th, Lindelof sent 7 of the 8 final episodes to critics, along with a note pleading with them not to binge-watch the series. Michael Schneider, host of KCRW's podcast The Spinoff and executive editor of IndieWire, recently sat down with Lindelof, who had a confession to make.
I have to preface this by saying that I'm a complete and total hypocrite, which I mentioned in the letter, that I am prone to binge. At the same time, I do feel that we should exercise some degree of self-restraint. And just because you can binge doesn't mean you should. And I've found this sort of fascinating idea of binging and the fact that we use that word to describe it, because sort of prior to 3 or 4 years ago, binging is just a universally bad word.
Yeah, it's odd because it was sort of associated with eating disorders. But,
yes,
but now
I just think of that Meredith Baxter Burney television movie of the week where she's like grabbing things of cookies off the supermarket shelves and just stuffing them down her mouth.
May I binge with Pringles?
Yes, exactly. But I think there probably are some shows that are great to binge, particularly comedies. But I think most of my peers, when we are told, oh my God, I watched your entire season in a day, they're sort of like, oh, that's cool that you watched it, but then a little bit of disappointment that it was consumed at such incredible velocity.
Right, right. Well, especially because then it's done. That's it. You're getting nothing else for a long time to come.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, when Stranger Things was available on Netflix and it was sort of the show of the summer, I felt like I had no cultural cachet if I hadn't seen it. And so I felt incumbent upon to watch the entire thing at this incredible rate of speed. So I watched Stranger Things over the course of 2 days and I loved it, but then it was over and I just kind of felt, I wish I just watched one a day. I still could have watched the entire thing in a week. But I also think like this idea of anticipation. I just think that feeling, that Christmas morning feeling of opening up your presents really doesn't exist in a binge culture.
Yeah.
And for The Leftovers, we finished shooting all 8 episodes, which was a rarity for us in terms of normally we're still kind of editing the show when it premieres. So there are only like 2 or 3 that we can send out. But I sort of felt we have all these episodes. If we don't send out most of them, the critics are going to say, why are you holding them back? And I know that there's just so much television out there right now for everybody to be watching. So if people will get a prescription medication and there's a dosage on it, I sort of feel like it's incumbent upon the storytellers to say, here's 7 episodes of The Leftovers. Take one with food, you know, once a day. Or without food.
Yeah.
And this is what I'm prescribing. But I also understand that people should be able to watch shows in the way that they want to watch them. And I sound like a bit of an old fogey shouting from my porch in my rocking chair.
Do you sort of find it surreal that you ended up kind of in this same place now talking about the final season of a TV show? And was this the plan? Were you ready to kind of jump back into series television and leading up to a big finale that people are going to be talking about? You're kind of back here again.
Yeah, I mean, I think what my wife would say, as I related to her many, many times after Lost ended, was I'm never doing this again. I don't want to work 90 hours a week. I don't want to be away from my house all the time, et cetera, et cetera. And then I read Tom's book and I fell in love. And I think that that's the way that inspiration works, which is it's a very abstract idea. I want to do another television show, but what's the show? And so when Tom and I first met and talked about his book, I said, look, I think this is a television series, but I think it's a finite television series because who wants to watch a lot of people being depressed and suicidal all the time? And he was in complete agreement. And I think he and I both felt like the show was going to be about 3 or 4 seasons, but 5 seasons felt like it was too long. And then we arrived at the end of the second season, and it was very clear to us that we were coming down the hill as opposed to still climbing it. And in fact, even many of the critics who hated the first season and then loved the second season, they were saying after the second season finale, you know what? I'm good. Like, this is a good place to end it. And at that point, we were like, oh, geez, like, should there even be a third season? But there were a couple of ideas that we found intoxicating. And when HBO asked us to do another season, we said to them, we would love to, but can it be the last one? And HBO was like, we're great with that, which is, I think, a unique It's less unique now than it was when Carlton and I asked for the end of Lost, but particularly I think because our show is ratings challenged. Is that an accurate assessment?
That's a nice way to put it, right?
But they were like, cool with it. And even looking at a juggernaut like Game of Thrones, you know, they said, we want to end Game of Thrones, and HBO is letting them do that. And that's a huge success. So I think that this idea of the audience wants to know how thick the book is when they pick it up and how close you are to the end. I think that that's really reassuring to the audience. And certainly for us as storytellers, it was really exciting to write a definitive, as definitive as I'm capable of, ending for the show versus just another one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you guys did break that barrier at Lost because that just was unheard of until you did that. And then after that, it changed the business. Like, this is now kind of the norm.
Yeah, I think certainly in the broadcast space, that wasn't happening unless it was a comedy like Cheers or Seinfeld or Friends, where usually the cast, the actors were like, you know, I'm done playing Chandler. That's me being Matthew Perry. But it's like, that's why you end a show. It's like, you're never going to run out of Friends stories. But I think that The Sopranos, David Chase was like, we're ending the show. And in a cable space, that was possible. And it was still phenomenally successful. So when we were arguing for an end date of Lost to be announced as early as the second season of Lost, when we were still doing 24, 25 episodes a season, it wasn't until the middle of the third season when the network really saw the creative strains of what it took to keep the people on the island and not be moving forward that they said, all right, we'll let you end it after six, which was a huge relief to us. You know, I make no apologies for Lost. I'm immensely proud of everything that we did on that show, but I've always contended that the show went on for at least a season too long.
I would disagree with that.
Oh, okay.
But I do love that they're now protecting Hawaii, or a bunch of them are protecting Hawaii as part of 5-0.
So they must. They must.
Now, HBO underwent a regime change after the season 3 was picked up. Michael Lombardo, who is a big supporter of the show, left. Were you concerned that you would still be able to do a third season?
We were actually, I think, shooting the first episode when Mike left and Casey came in, and Casey went out of his way right out of the gate to say, hey, I'm a big fan of the show. I think if we were not in our final year, I would probably experience some anxiety about what the direction of the network moving forwards is. But at the end of the day, I think that the brand of HBO and the kind of television that they want to do, you know, transcends any individual, and that the leftovers was now at that point, you know, by season 2 and certainly by its final season, it was executing what it needed to be executing to be on HBO's air.
Well, and it kind of worked out in that your final season is coming on now, where I can't help but think about what's kind of going on right now in the world and in the country and the real anxiety that people actually do have.
What are you talking about? I have no idea what you're talking exactly. about. I've actually been out of town for a couple months. What's going on?
And I'm sure you've been asked this a lot, but I can't help but think about it now because personally having some real anxiety about the world and what the future is and a lot of uncertainty, the kind of things that The Leftovers has addressed since season 1. Do you think that might change the way people view the show going into the final season?
We started writing the show in January of 16 and finished writing basically at the end of August. And I will say that there were many political discussions that happened in the writer's room, but the arguments that we would have were more about Bernie versus Hillary. In other words, there was a broad range of liberal thought,
right,
but not a single one of us felt that Donald Trump was going to be elected the president of the United States. And so many things that we put into the show this season, particularly because it is contemplating the literal end of the world, that we were kind of thinking that it would be funny, that it would be at least cheeky in some way, because it would be airing in the spring in a Hillary Clinton presidency, and we kind of make light of nuclear accidents and widespread panic. And I think that we probably would have reevaluated some of that thinking had we known what the outcome of the election was going to be. But here we are.
Coming up after a short break, Damon Lindelof tells us where he stands on the possibility of another writer's strike and why he's never, ever getting back on Twitter. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. Ingest.
There it goes. Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're listening to a conversation between Michael Schneider, host of KCRW's The Spinoff, and writer-producer Damon Lindelof. The third and final season of his HBO series, The Leftovers, premieres April 16th. The Leftovers has explored life in two small towns, one in New York and the other in Texas, following an event that may or may not have been the apocalypse. Suddenly, 140 million people around the world disappeared into thin air. This season, the show moves to Australia as the main characters, played by Justin Theroux and Carrie Coon, prepare to flee the U.S. in the hours before a rumored flood of biblical proportions.
G'day, ladies and gentlemen. As we prepare to board our flight to Melbourne, please do so in a calm and orderly fashion. While worldwide flooding is expected, we should be taking off before the rain begins.
Lindelof says shooting down under required some adjustment.
There is a different culture of filmmaking there. We're used to, for example, having 12 to 14-hour shooting days. In Australia, it's 10 hours. They don't break for lunch. And so it's just basically, it's run and gun. And technically, they're brilliant, but it's sort of like, hey, we have lives. You know, after a 10-hour shooting day, we're leaving.
Yeah.
And so it forced us to sort of rethink the way that we shot the show, but also created this really unique and amazing energy. And I just have to say, Australia, there's just no place in the world like it. And I know that sounds like, duh, obviously. But from an American perspective, first off, it just feels really, really far. And if you're in Melbourne, it kind of looks like the U.S., but everything is a little bit weird and a little bit different. And if you just drive 10 minutes out of town, you feel like you're in the 1970s. And if you drive 10 minutes further, you're in the country.
Yeah. Was there also sort of an economic incentive in going to Australia as opposed to, I mean, hey, you know how to make Hawaii look like Australia.
Right.
You did that before.
We did not choose Australia because there was an economic benefit, but there ended up being a significant tax break in Australia, which helped us keep a lot of the money on the screen because traditionally, as a show goes on, it gets more expensive. But if you're ending a show, and more importantly, we are reducing, we did two less episodes this year than we did in prior years, so you can't amortize over as many episodes. So the tax rebate that Australia offered was a significant boon to us.
Yeah, yeah, because I weirdly remember when that Baywatch Hawaii actually moved to Australia.
But, oh, really?
Because it was cheaper to shoot in Australia than Hawaii.
Australia for Hawaii?
Fascinating. Yeah, which was a little strange. Another sort of hot topic in the world of writers right now is there's talk of a potential writer strike. Again, sort of coincidentally, that was something that impacted you back on Lost back in the day. Ultimately, you did a few episodes one season. But yep. As we stand now, is this something you're involved with? Are you paying attention to concerns over these negotiations?
I've always been very engaged by the Writers Guild. I haven't been on the board, but I've served on the two previous negotiating committees, and I've just been enlisted to join this one, and I'm honored to do so. My great-great-grandfather started the Painters Union in Chicago, and so I believe in the labor movement, and I think that in this day and age of basically six media conglomerates owning everything, that the writers union and certainly the actors and the directors as well need to be vigilant in terms of protecting our membership. And primarily the union doesn't necessarily look out for individuals like me who are showrunners because we can be in overall deals and we don't have to worry about making a living. But I think that the middle class of our union and the other unions is severely threatened by this idea of globalization. And particularly, I think that the television industry has changed so radically. When you think back to the strike that happened last time, the studios were contending that there was no money to be made in new media, that streaming and downloading were never going to supplant the cash flow of ad revenue. And here we are in 2017, and I just can't imagine that we're not on a trend for most television shows are going to be less episodes. Mm-hmm. The metrics by which we measure financial success completely and totally shifted. And no one is denying that the companies are reporting $51 billion in profit just last year. And yet no one is also disputing that the metrics that the artists who basically provide and make this content are actually making less. And so obviously some sort of labor action is not the desired result in any way, shape, or form. But absent some sort of a work stoppage or a strike threat, there's no leverage in these sort of negotiations. And it can be very awkward because I have great relationships with my employers. You know, I enjoy spending time with and talking on the phone with not the CEOs of these companies, but very high level executives, and it can get tense. But the reality is I feel duty bound to look after certain things like our health plan that will be severely adversely affected if we don't get some of the things that we're asking for.
And the health fund is actually an important part of this negotiation. So The Leftovers, obviously, as it ends its run, people are going to be able to watch the show forever, though. You know, that's, I guess, the great thing about the modern technology, the way people now watch TV is these newfangled platforms.
Sure,
but are you excited by the idea of people discovering this show for years to come?
It's been really exciting to have the inverse of Lost happen, where Lost basically had such huge viewership out of the gate. And obviously, it premiered in 2004, so I think it was before, you know, streaming was readily available. Yeah. By the time of it ended its run, that was just starting to happen with iTunes and downloads, but Apple TV didn't even exist yet. And so The Leftovers started very small, and now I feel like people are discovering it. Now I kind of feel like, oh, there's this kind of snowball effect. It will never be a massive phenomenon on the level of Breaking Bad, which again started very small, but then because I think largely because Netflix existed and people caught up on previous seasons, by the end of its run, it was a ratings juggernaut.
Yeah.
But it is, people were asking me, like, what do you want to do when Lost ends? And it's like, my dream is to have a show on HBO, just a cool little like niche prestige HBO drama on Sunday nights. And The Leftovers got to be that show. We only made 28 episodes, which is 3 more episodes than the first season of Lost. But I'm immensely proud of the work that we did. And it's going to be hard to do something, you know, that lives up to the feeling that I'm having right now in terms of the pride that I experience making it.
Can you also promise me that you're not going to care what people say this time with the finale?
No, I'm not going to promise you that at all. I care deeply and profoundly.
Yeah.
If you could hypnotize me and be like, I can make you not care about what anybody thinks about your work, I wouldn't let you do it because, you know, me caring what people think about my work is really important to my work. I mean, on one side of it, it makes me seem needy and pathetic, but on the other side of it, it's the drive to connect. That's what this medium is particularly television. And one of the things that I've learned is, you know, I'm much more comfortable working in TV than in movies, and largely because TV is functioning in a much more intimate space. And I just feel like the ability to connect that television has is really profound. And if I didn't care about connecting, if I didn't care what people thought of, you know, of my work, I don't think that I would want to do it anymore.
Yeah, yeah. But we're not going to get you back on Twitter, are we?
Never.
No?
I'm on Instagram. Instagram seems much nicer.
Oh, yeah, because
it's a visual medium.
It's pictures of your pets, your kids, and your food.
And what you're eating, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There are parts of Twitter that I really miss because there were a number of people that I followed who I just thought were brilliant and funny. I felt connected to them through that medium. I miss that part of it, but I do not miss the other parts of it because in a lot of ways, I've earned a reputation as being somewhat of a whipping boy, both for the way that Lost ended or my propensity to do ambiguous storytelling, mystery-driven storytelling without resolution, etc. But I invited that. I feel like I went on a Twitter and said, who wants to say something about me? Come on. You know, I know you're whispering about me. Just say it. And so I don't think that I could just go on Twitter and make funny jokes about the current administration without somebody basically saying, oh, you're going to dig on Jeff Sessions? What about the Lost finale? You know, maybe Jeff Sessions could find out where the polar bears came from. That's the way that I imagine my worst critics sound. But, yeah.
Damon Lindelof, writer, producer, co-creator of The Leftovers on HBO. Thanks for joining us.
So good to be here. Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Special thanks this week to IndieWire's Michael Schneider, who picked up the interviewing duties while I was out of town. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.